You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the Relief Primary Care SmartCast Microlearning Podcast Series, hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Sylvia Hanna, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast, which is one of six podcasts. In this series, we will be covering the role of GLP-1 receptor agonists in the care of patients with type 2 diabetes. In today's podcast, we will discuss barriers to treatment and how to overcome those barriers. Joining me today is Davida F. Kruger, a certified nurse practitioner in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, Bone and Mineral Disease at Henry Ford Health System in Detroit, Michigan. Welcome, Ms. Kruger. It's so good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the podcast.
Davida, many of those with type 2 diabetes are not achieving treatment goals. We know that this leads to diabetes complications. Can you elaborate on this?
Absolutely. First, with the medications and tools that we do have, the standards of care indicate that most people with diabetes should have an A1C of less than 7%. With widespread use of continuous glucose monitoring, the standards also indicate that people with diabetes should have their glucose in time, what we call time in range, of greater than 70% while avoiding low blood glucose and also higher blood glucoses. And then complications associated with type 2 diabetes include micro and macrovascular complications, and their associated adverse outcomes are related to suboptimal glycemic control. We know that. We've seen it for years in clinical research. We also know that each 1% reduction in the mean A1C has been shown to be associated with a reduction risk of 37% of microvascular complications and 21% for deaths related to diabetes, with 14% decrease for myocardial infarctions. So many of our patients have hypertension, elevated lipids, eye changes, kidney changes. We believe they're all associated with the level of control of their diabetes, and we really need to improve this.
Davida, what are some of the barriers to self-care management?
Well, I think we need to recognize that the barrier can come from both the healthcare provider and the patient. On the healthcare provider side, it's important to understand the standards of care, all the new medications, when and how to use them, goals for these patients, patients' belief systems, shared decision-making, all of these things about type 2 diabetes. And often, in the middle of a very busy primary care practice, it's really hard to do. And then for the patient, it is understanding the seriousness of diabetes. I see all the time when our patients do not understand how serious type 2 diabetes. We want to be sure they can access resources and education. We want to look at best ways to help them access and use newer medications, newer therapies, newer tools, things like continuous glucose monitoring. And all patients with diabetes should be provided diabetes education, medical nutritional therapy. That means they should be able to see a diabetes educator and a dietitian, and they have an opportunity to see those ongoing, not only at diagnosis, but when we're making changes in their therapy or not achieving treatment goals. So seeing a dietitian is often key in making those lifestyle changes that we talk about all the time. And then, of course, shared decision-making with the patient is core to all of the care. Also helps engage the patient for self-care management and behaviors. So the patient has to agree to the type of therapy and want to be able to do that. And all of these things help them engage to be successful.
There is so much to know about diabetes from the patient perspective. What's the best approach in educating these patients so they're not overwhelmed with all of the information?
You're absolutely right. There really is a lot to know about diabetes. And as a healthcare provider, we need to be able to assess where the patient is in terms of their own healthcare, their own healthcare needs, and their understanding of diabetes. And then we need to develop a plan of care with that patient. So we don't want to have a cookie cutter for every patient. And the patient has to have input That's what helps make them be successful. And then the outcome will be more positive. So diabetes care is more than just the medications we prescribe. And I think that's what happens in our very busy practice. Oh, let's try this or let's try that. But it requires many lifestyle changes. And when you're making a lifestyle change, it doesn't only affect the patient, but it affects the whole family unit. And when we can engage that family unit, that's really helpful. So we need to engage these individuals in their healthcare decision and their family members, their support system, their friends, anyone that can help them understand the outcome and the seriousness of their diabetes and help them be successful. And then providing with treatment goals is also helpful. Instead of just saying, measure your blood glucose, say before your meals, this is what your number should be. After your meals, this is what your number should be. This is what we're looking for when we have blood pressure checks. And what are your goals in the next month or the next 3 months? What should your A1C look like or your time in range? What is your goal for your cholesterol or your lipids? I really think the patient needs to have these numbers. And if I have a patient who has an A1C of 9 or 10%, I don't say in the next 3 months, we're going to get you to less than 7%. I have along the way goals so that the patient again can feel successful. And then when I order labs, I explain to the patient what they are, why we need them, what the goals of the outcomes are, and make sure that I circle back to explain the results of each of these labs. So also the patient's understanding what these goals are will take time, but that we can work together to achieve them, I think is really important. And then a team approach includes certified diabetes educators, clinical pharmacists, anyone else that can have input to make the patient successful, and then recommend support groups for the patient. Sometimes it's online. Facebook friends are helpful, and I see many support groups online for diabetes, and I think sometimes that's helpful for our patients as well.
Tabita, how do you work with patients to get self-monitoring of blood glucose data? Is that a challenge?
Well, it can be a challenge, and it's really frustrating if we don't have some data to help our patients when they come in for a visit. And we use both self-monitoring blood glucose and continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, to get data from our patients. And if we can use CGM, that's so much nicer for our patients. But based on the type of their therapy the patient is on, we do prescribe a personal CGM for patients whose insurance that do not cover personal CGM. We often will use professional CGM periodically, which means maybe 2 to 4 times a year. We ask them to wear a sensor. They return that. We have some lovely data that we can then intervene with. And then if we don't have the option for either, we do self-monitoring of blood glucose with finger sticks. And most insurance companies will pay for the finger sticks at least 2 times daily, no matter what the therapy the patient is on. And it's uncomfortable to do finger sticks. So sometimes we have to coax the patient. And sometimes we'll say, okay, you know, do one a day and then move it around. You know, so today we're going to do before breakfast. Tomorrow we're going to do before dinner. And please write it down. But always before you come in for the visit, please be sure if you're not wearing CGM that you get me some finger stick data. And so, of course, most patients prefer CGM without having to do any finger sticks. And that's data is so much more helpful to the healthcare provider, but we educate our patients to use either CGM or to do regular self-monitoring of blood glucose, knowing that data helps to keep folks on track as well as helps us with patient care and helps with a positive outcome. It also helps the patient understand when they exercise or eat particular foods, it gives them feedback to what that means. And so if they see a better blood sugar because they went out and walked around the block, that's, you know, positive reinforcement for that patient.
Many of the newer medications are injectables. How do you approach a patient to have a conversation about taking injection? Is there resistance?
So I think the conversation has changed since GLP-1s have come to market. So you can imagine before that, we may have had to convince a patient to do 3 or 4 blood sugars a day, 2 blood sugars a day, 3 to 4 injections a day. That's a lot of work for our patients. However, with the GLP-1s, they're usually once a week with a small needle. And then we can say to the patient, it's once a week. It does not cause hypoglycemia. It has a cardiovascular benefit. And guess what? You probably will lose weight. And it's much easier to get a patient to take a once a week injectable when I can say all of those things. But you do want to talk to the patient about what their fears are, because they may have seen Aunt Sally give an injection 20 years ago with a long needle, and Aunt Sally already had complications related to their diabetes, and they think the insulin or the medications, which are not insulin that we're talking about at this very moment, cause the complications. And so their fears and concerns are real, and we need to talk to them about that. But we also then say, you know, it's totally different. We're not talking about that. And the convenience of these medications and the accuracy of using a once a week pen is so much different than syringe therapy of years gone by. And we really want the patient to understand how to use the pen. And one of the things we do is not only provide written instructions as part of the take-home message, but we have the patient take their very first injection in the office with us. And after that, they're like, oh, is that all it is? So once a week, with the benefit that it causes a good A1C reduction, weight reduction, has a cardiovascular benefit, and also has weight lowering, usually can get our patients to take that without much difficulty.
Well, that is good. How do you approach managing patients with comorbidities and perhaps polypharmacy that may complicate the management?
That's an ongoing problem for managing diabetes, because my patients have diabetes, hypertension, elevated lipids. They might have thyroid disease. They have a host of a number of other comorbidities that go along with their diabetes. And we have to make sure that there is no interaction with these medications. We have to make sure that the patient takes them correctly. They take them on a regular basis. And so there are multiple medications with real challenges to remember to take them. You know, I am an advocate of a pill box for medications that can potentially go into those, helping that patient keep track of them. Not only that, keeping track of their refills and making sure that their medication arrived. We use a lot of mail order to be sure that the patient gets their medication. And then you have to worry about the prohibitiveness of the cost, not only of the medications, but the co-pays. And so if you have 6 or 8 or 9 medications, and you have co-pays on all of those, that could hurt as well. But we really want to make sure that the patient has the opportunity to get these medications, they understand how to use them, they understand the benefit and rationale. So if you have a pill box full of pills and you don't know why you're taking each one of them, you may not want to take each one of them. So why do we want you to take a lipid lowering medication or a blood pressure medication? And this happens all the time when a patient has no concept of why they're taking it. So again, shared decision-making to make sure the patient understands why they're taking those medications. And a lot can be achieved through collaborative relationships with the practitioner, who encourages patient education about medication use, maintaining routine medication administration times, allowing self-management, and providing positive attitudes. And if you have the ability to schedule an appointment with a clinical pharmacist, and that's very possible in many of the hospitals, those individuals will look at the patient's medications, help them find coupons if it's appropriate, find better cost to the medications, make sure there's no interaction, and explain those medications to the patient. So I find all of that to not only be challenging, but we can make it happen for these patients. We just need to be aware so that we're proactively helping these patients.
How do you encourage success with GLP-1 receptor agonists?
So, you know, GLP-1 RAs have been around for about 20 years, and I've actually done a bunch of the clinical studies that have brought them to market. So I think the first thing is explaining to the patient how they work and the benefits they provide. But what we know about the person who has type 2 diabetes is that they don't have a trigger to stop eating. What happens is their brain says, you're still hungry, because that's where the brain is the turnoff valve for hunger. And unless we give the patient who is missing GLP-1, all people have type 2 diabetes are deficient in GLP-1, unless we replace that, they don't get a sense of satiety in their brain. They don't know not to eat. So additionally, if you have type 2 diabetes, your food doesn't stay in your tummy long enough. You have rapid gastric emptying and you're hungry because the food's not staying around, and you have a rise in blood sugars after meals. Now, if I give this patient GLP-1, I can correct all of that. And there's a lot of other things that GLP-1 does correct. But what you have to keep in mind, now the patient's going to get a sense of fullness, sense of satiety. The food is going to stay around longer. If a patient's been eating a lot of food, we need to cut that in half and maybe even give them less than that to help them with that sense of fullness. And so that will decrease any nausea or GI symptoms associated with starting a GLP-1. So we want to make sure that the patient understands what's been missing in type 2 diabetes, that the GLP-1 will give them a sense of fullness, sense of satiety. In of itself, when we initiate therapy, there may be some transient nausea, but to get rid of most of the nausea, avoid high-fat food, eat less food. If you're still getting nausea, eat less than you thought you were eating, and we get to lower other medications, and we're going to titrate slowly. So the first dose of whichever GLP-1 we're using, we're going to keep you on it for at least 4 weeks. We're going to check in with you before we increase the dosing to see how things are going. We want you to eat smaller meals, eat slower, stop when you feel that sense of fullness, and that patient will be much more successful and getting the benefit of these medications and also see the weight reduction. So again, the first injection should always be in the office so the patient can see how easy it is. We also do virtual visits. So if we have the patient comes in the office, we order the medication, the patient picks it up, or it's delivered to their home. We can also do a virtual visit if the demonstration we showed them was not enough. So, but we can usually resolve most of any of the GI side effects by talking to them about the smaller meals and slowly titrating the medication.
Thank you, Devita. That was very informative. We learned a lot today about overcoming barriers to treatment in type 2 diabetes. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. We hope you will join us for the other podcasts in this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Novo Nordisk, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity.